The bipartisan deficit reduction plan by the so-called Gang of Six is, as we heard on NPR News, getting a cool reception in the House of Representatives. So is this going to be the breakthrough or not when it comes to the debt limit debate? Is this the answer to long-term deficit reduction? We will welcome your thoughts and your questions about it for our guest analyst. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Thursday, July the 21st. President Obama is praising the plan. He says it's broadly consistent with the White House's approach to raising the debt limit as it includes spending cuts and revenue increases. After a meeting this week, the Gang of Six proclaimed that it is gaining support in the Senate, with one declaring, "We've gone from a gang of six to a mob of 50. But today that enthusiasm appears to be fading, with conservatives complaining about raising taxes and liberals concerned that it would cut entitlement benefits too much. We again will welcome your questions. Wonder if you support this approach or not, at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let me welcome our guest. Mark Goldwine is Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Good morning.
Oh, thanks for having me. Good morning.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. So broadly, what does this Gang of Six bipartisan plan include?
Well, the basics of the plan is two parts. Part one is what they're calling a down payment, and that's about $500 billion of deficit reduction that can take place over the next 5 years, but go into effect immediately. And then part two is a process that kind of will force the committees of jurisdiction, the committees that have all the expertise, to do the rest, to do another $3 to $3.5 trillion in the next 6 months. And that additional $3 to $3.5 trillion reduction includes kind of some of the big things, like comprehensive tax reform that lowers the tax rates drastically, and Social Security reform that puts that program on a permanently solvent path, and things like that.
Well, where do the revenue increases come in?
Well, when you do comprehensive tax reform in the way the gang is talking about, you lower the rates, but you also do something called broadening the base, which is essentially eliminating or else limiting a lot of these deductions, credits, exclusions, other tax breaks in the code. If you do that, you know, the Gang of Six recommendations are based on the Fiscal Commission, and the Fiscal Commission found that you could lower the top rate to 28% and still raise $1 trillion of revenue over 10 years.
By closing loopholes and limiting deductions.
Exactly.
Yeah, so why are conservatives complaining about the tax increases in this?
Well, conservatives understandably want a spending-focused solution. And conservatives think that we have a spending problem, and so we should bring spending under control. Where I break with conservatives is many of them also think that means there can't be even a revenue component, even if that comes from cutting things that looked exactly like spending but happen to be administered by the IRS and the tax code. Many of them have signed this pledge that says they won't support any revenue for any reason ever, and that becomes problematic when you're talking about a grand bargain for deficit reduction.
Yeah. So talk about the spending cuts. Is everything on the table here?
I think so. The gang, again, is inspired by the work of the Fiscal Commission, which four of the gang members were on and voted for. And the Fiscal Commission had this principle that it wasn't going to hit means-tested programs, that is, programs that protect the most vulnerable, and it wasn't going to hit investments. But other than that, everything was on the table, and it seems that everything continues to be on the table with the gang. That includes changes to Medicare and Medicaid. That includes cuts to defense and non-defense spending, everything.
What sorts of Medicaid or Medicare cuts would be included?
Again, it's up to the Finance Committee to work out the exact details, but if they were going to base their recommendations on the Fiscal Commission, which they're of the same magnitude, so you would expect to see similar things, Options include expanding cost sharing rules so that people have more standardized deductibles and coinsurance. They include reducing payments to certain providers and to drug companies. They include looking at, there's this scam that states pull where what they'll do is they'll tax providers just to increase their reimbursement rate, and then they can get a bigger match from the federal government. Closing that loophole would actually save a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. So from your perspective on the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, is this the responsible approach to reduce the deficit and maybe break this debt limit debate?
Well, the responsible approach would have been to deal with this 10 years ago when the economy was looking pretty good and we had a lot of time before the baby boomers were going to retire. We're long past that, obviously. And given where we are, this seems like the best path forward. This is a bipartisan plan that's gaining serious momentum in the Senate and would actually put the debt on a downward path. It wouldn't solve our debt and deficit problems. It wouldn't let us put this issue to bed forever, but it would put us in the right direction in a very serious way.
Mm-hmm. And are you concerned with what we just heard on NPR News that, that the House of Representatives is giving this a cool reception? Apparently, more senators like it than the House of Representatives.
I'm not shocked that conservatives don't want to raise taxes and liberals don't want to cut benefits. The question is, are they all going to be able to put that aside for the greater good? And this morning, I'm usually optimistic. I think that there is a chance that we can reach a grand bargain. It may not be identical to the Gang of Six proposal. May get moved a little bit to the left or a little bit to the right. They may nip and tuck or even change it significantly. But I think that we have a real shot here of doing something big and something real.
We're talking with Mark Goldwein, who is Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. He's talking with us about this bipartisan compromise plan from the so-called Gang of Six in the U.S. Senate. We're wondering what questions you have about this plan, whether you favor or are concerned about this approach. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter or tweet us a question, twitter.com/Joy Cardine Show. Checking the weather forecast for today, mostly sunny, hot and humid, especially in the far south. A slight chance of afternoon storms in the southwest. Highs today, 85 to 92 degrees. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's coming up on 17 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Thursday, July the 21st. Coming up later today after 5 during At Issue with Ben Marins, Cornell College in Iowa uses a block plan calendar which enables students to focus on one subject at a time. After 5, join Ben and his guest when they discuss a new educational concept known as One Course at a Time. That's coming up during At Issue with Ben Marins after 5 o'clock. My nephew went to Cornell College, and he enjoyed that approach. We are talking about deficit reduction and the debt limit and this bipartisan plan from the Senate's Gang of Six with Mark Goldwein, Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. And our first caller is Wade in Madison. Hello, Wade.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Thank you. I was wanting to ask the question of Mark about his comment that the conservatives understandably want to focus on debt reduction, but have, an absolute zero tolerance for any kind of revenue increase. And to me, it seems like not only a blind ideology that is completely uncompromising, which is ultimately damaging to reaching this deal, which I would support, but I also wonder, if there isn't just a blatant degree of political motivation, that it's not even political in terms of wanting to do what their constituents want them to do, but rather just anti-Obama and, a definite partisan approach supported by what almost amounts to only a soundbite turned into a religion. you know, that's how it comes across. I'm just wondering, you know, Mark, your thoughts on that.
You know, I think this is one of the paradoxes of presidential leadership. Wherever a president moves, and this is not really a partisan issue, the opposing party is going to move away, and that makes it very hard to cut a deal, either in private or in public. That's an unfortunate feature of our political system. As for this tax pledge, I think one of the tragedies of it is the unwillingness of some Republicans to address taxes actually means they can't address spending, because some of the biggest spending that we do, we call tax breaks, but they look just like spending. For example, there's really no difference between a Pell Grant and a tax credit for college education. They're really identical. There's really no difference between a farm subsidy and an ethanol tax credit. They're really identical. But by being so stern in this pledge, Republicans aren't able to cut the spending in the tax code, which really, you know, Tom Coburn, who's very conservative, calls this socialism in the tax code, and that's probably an exaggeration, but his point is Republicans should be jumping to try to cut this stuff instead of jumping away from it.
So while you said it was understandable that conservatives didn't want to raise taxes, you're saying that you know, these loopholes and credits are not the same thing as raising taxes?
That's exactly right. That's one of the brilliant things behind the gang's proposal is it actually cuts taxes. It cuts tax rates for everyone, and it gets to the ultimate minimum tax. It pays for that by cutting these deductions and credits and exclusions.
Peter on Facebook writes, "This proposal uses the same faulty Washington accounting that got us into this mess. It's not a cut when spending goes up. It also does not change spending on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, which we will have to reform if we want to avoid being in the same position, but with more debt, in a few years. It is fiscally impossible to keep those items as we know them today." Mark?
That's absolutely right. Our fundamental problem going forward is the growth of Medicare and Medicaid, and to a lesser extent, Social Security. On Social Security, the gang's plan calls for a comprehensive reform that makes it solvent for the next 75 years. Again, it pushes that to the committee, but the committee should have a pretty good starting point because the Fiscal Commission put forward a plan that raises the retirement age, reduces benefits for high earners, makes some changes to the tax side, etc. On health care, they call for about $500 billion of spending cuts over the next decade and a cap over the long run that would force healthcare to grow no faster than GDP plus one. Now, I mean, I have to be honest with you. This $500 billion, this is going to be a big step towards improving the state of our healthcare problems, but it's not going to put them on a sustainable path. This is an issue where really nobody knows how to control healthcare over the long run, and we're going to have to come back to it again and again and again over the next years and decades. And that's why this cap is so important, because it forces us to revisit this issue again and again and again. And unfortunately, it's not like Social Security where you can just solve it once and then be done with it.
Owen in De Pere is with us. Hello, Owen. Owen, are you there? Owen, please ask your question. I think I hear him, but he's not hearing me. Anyway, Owen wanted to know, you just talked about Social Security, and I've heard this question many times. Why is Social Security even on the table? This isn't a part of the deficit, and you know, it's paid for.
Well, Social Security is paid for out of a combination of its dedicated revenue, the payroll tax, and its trust fund. The problem is its dedicated revenue already is insufficient to pay for its benefits. So right now it's actually dipping into its trust fund. And when it dips into its trust fund, that means it has to take the money from the rest of the government, which puts strain on the rest of our government. More importantly, in 2036, Social Security's trust fund goes empty. At that point, there's a 23% across-the-board cut for everyone, rich, poor, disabled, you know, 85-year-old, 62-year-old. Everyone would get a 23% across-the-board cut. That's not an acceptable outcome. And the longer we wait to actually make the program solvent, the more severe the changes we'll need to make to avoid that.
Now, back to Medicare briefly before we move on. Did the Fiscal Commission want to do anything close to Paul Ryan's plan when it came to reforming Medicare?
Right. So for a little bit of background, Paul Ryan's plan would effectively replace Medicare for those under 55 with a subsidy system that gave you subsidies to buy private insurance with risk adjustments and adjustments for income and things like that. The Fiscal Commission did not go there, but we did recognize that something like that does need to be thought about, because the truth is, as painful as that option looks like, we have no idea how to control healthcare costs over the long run, and we should be looking at all options. And so what the Fiscal Commission said was, let's test out this premium support model through the FEHB, which is through the federal health plan, and let's see how it goes, and let's do some studies. And if it goes well, we can talk about, you know, after 2020, implementing it a little more widely. Maybe not how Paul Ryan did it, but maybe, for example, how Alice Riven and Pete DiMenschi did in their plan, where traditional Medicare continues to be able to compete with the private plans. There was not consensus in the commission that that's where we should go, but there was consensus that we need to be keeping our options open.
Larry in Madison is with us now. Hello, Larry.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I'm opposed to the gang's plan. It's not fair to the middle class or to the lower class. A fair plan would effect huge cuts in the military budget, which has tripled in about 14 years. Now, the plan, as your guest said, does call for military cuts. However, the military-industrial complex and United States foreign policy will prevent big war budget cuts. The complex will push Congress to approve new weapons systems, and our foreign policy will continue to antagonize foreign powers. So this is not going to work unless we change our foreign policy and our campaign finance system.
All right. Thank you very much, Larry. The military cuts are not enough, according to our caller, Mark Goldwyn. What do you say?
Well, I have to say, Larry, it seems like your argument is, I don't support the Gang of Six plan because I don't think it's going to work. The truth is, the Gang of Six plan does have pretty severe military cuts. It cuts defense deeper than even the president has proposed doing it. The Fiscal Commission suggests a lot of ways that you could do this by first going after inefficiencies of weapon systems and things like that. But these cuts are fairly deep, and if they don't happen, your opposition isn't to the plan. Your opposition is to the broader system. I don't really think that that's an argument for any people are making, that that the defense cuts in this plan are not deep enough.
Were the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, do they account for a big part of our deficit right now?
It's a definitional question. Essentially, we're paying $150-$200 billion this year on Iraq and Afghanistan. The good news is, and that's a lot. I mean, we have a $1 trillion deficit, so that's, or over $1 trillion deficit. So that's 15 or 20% of our deficit this year. And that's in addition to all the interest that we're paying on our past borrowing. The good news on this spending is it appears like it's going to decline pretty quickly according to, our current withdrawal plans. And so it doesn't look like in the future it's going to continue to be a large weight on our deficit.
Yeah. And the Pentagon is balking at getting these kinds of cuts or going along with them?
Well, it's not clear yet. I'll say the president's proposal to cut defense is not as deep as the proposal that the gang has.
Okay.
So I don't know if they've talked to Leon Panetta or anyone at the Pentagon. But
our next caller is Linda in Monroe. Hello, Linda.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Mr. Goldwyn. Now, I don't think it's going to work either. Now, here's the unbelievable part of the Gang of Six that I don't believe. It says to balance the budget, they're going to make cuts in the social programs that would irritate the Democrats. Now, on the Republican side, they said they were going to raise the taxes on the wealthy by cutting the tax loopholes, which I don't believe they're going to do because they could have done that years and years ago. And then to make this whole thing work to pay off the debt, they're going to lower the taxes from 35% down to 29%. So I think the only people that are going to benefit from this are the wealthy.
So let me tell you. If you look at their tax reform, if you look at the Fiscal Commission's tax reform, something that we found was most of the benefits of these various tax loopholes go to the very wealthy. And so, in fact, you can put together a tax plan that reduces the top rate from 35% to 28% and still asks those at the top to pay the most. Our particular plan we put forward in the Fiscal Commission had the top 1% paying 11% more of their income. It had the bottom one, the top bottom 20% actually getting a small tax cut, and it had people in the middle quintiles only paying about 1% more of their income. So you could do this in a fair and progressive way and still improve efficiency by lowering the tax rates.
Do you have any common position on the House-passed cut, cap, and balance plan that the Senate is going to be taking up today? Looks like the Senate's not going to go along with that balanced budget amendment idea. What about you?
So the basis of this is let's cut spending to a share of GDP. Let's cap it, effectively loan to cap it at what Paul Ryan had proposed in his budget, and then let's have a balanced budget amendment. The president has issued a veto statement on this. It's not going to make it through the Senate. I think it was important for House members to in some sense, blow off some steam and to show what it is that they stand for, which is, in the ideal world, they would love to have spending down to 18 or 19 or 20% of GDP, and they would love to have a balanced budget. That's an important principle, and it's good that everyone now understands where they stand. But we need to move on to something that can pass both houses and be signed by the president and is going to bring our debt under control.
We're talking with Mark Goldwein, Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, talking about the bipartisan compromise plan by the so-called Gang of Six in the Senate, and wondering if this is the solution to long-term deficit reduction and the stalemate over raising the debt limit. We'll continue after we check the latest news. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. The Wisconsin State Journal is praising the bipartisan Gang of Six plan to deficit reduction. In an editorial this morning, the paper opines the package would reduce the deficit by $3.7 trillion over a decade by slowing the growth of Medicare, capping federal agency spending, cutting the Pentagon, trimming farm subsidies, and controlling pension costs. The proposal would reduce marginal income tax rates while increasing overall revenue by closing tax loopholes and breaks. The extremes in both major political parties are sharply criticizing the plan, meaning it is probably headed in the right direction toward a workable solution. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is coming up on 7:37 on this Thursday, July the 21st. So what do you think? Is this a workable solution? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or send us a tweet on Twitter at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Mark Goldwein, Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. The Wisconsin State Journal, Mark, also says, though, that the Gang of Six proposal may be too complicated and controversial to schedule for a vote before the August 2nd deadline for lifting the debt ceiling. That's probably right?
Well, on our blog, crfb.org, we've actually looked into this issue. And the truth is, these senators have been drafting this for months. This isn't something they came up with last week. In terms of scoring it, most of this is actually instructions to committee, so I can score that pretty easily for you. If they're instructing a committee to reduce subsidies by $40 billion, it's going to save $40 billion. I don't really think that timing to get this into legislative language and scored is a problem. Where timing may be an issue is in negotiating this. The president hasn't weighed in with his preferences, nor has the House, nor have many of the senators. So they may want to do things to modify and change this. And that could take more time, and that could open the door for perhaps a short-term debt ceiling increase while they work out some of those details.
Okay. Do you have any comment on this alternative route that Congress is working on, the Mitch McConnell plan, that would cede authority to the president to raise the debt ceiling without needing Congress's involvement?
Well, that may well be the approach they take to raise the debt ceiling, but the McConnell approach still doesn't give us a path forward for how to reduce the debt. And I think If we don't raise the debt ceiling, it would be disastrous and would roil financial markets. But if we don't address the debt, we're really just postponing rather than limiting the chance of that default. And we need to do something to seriously address the debt.
Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm just trying to think of likely scenarios here. It could be that the president can raise the debt ceiling on his own, or it could be that some short-term debt ceiling increase is approved, and then this Gang of Six plan is worked out for the deficit reduction.
Yeah, or it could be some combination. I mean, they could merge the two plans. They could say, the way the McConnell plan actually would work is the Congress would give the president the authority to raise the debt ceiling in tranches, so not all at once. So what they could say is he can raise it by, you know, a few months now, and the second increase he can only raise conditional on us having reached an agreement on the deficit reduction plan. I mean, there's lots of ways to mix, match, and melt, but I think the important thing is if there's a shot at a big deal, they should be moving toward it.
Yeah, why do we even have a debt ceiling if it just keeps being raised?
I mean, this goes back to the 1920s. It used to be that anytime the president went to issue debt, Congress would have to approve that particular issuance. As you can imagine, when we're issuing debt on an hourly and daily basis, that doesn't really work in these modern times. And so we created a debt ceiling actually to make it easier rather than to make it more difficult to issue debt. As is, I think it is helpful in serving as a reminder of the consequences of the actions that politicians take. It would be better if politicians just wouldn't increase the deficit in the first place. But given that they've done that, I think it is useful every once in a while for them to take a hard vote to justify their increased spending and their tax cuts.
Our next caller is Linda in Sturgeon Bay. Hello, Linda. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi. I actually have two questions. The first question would be, is one of the loopholes that are going to be closed, would it be the elimination of home mortgage interest deduction and property tax deduction?
What's the second question?
Property tax deduction.
Okay. Gotcha. Well, the instructions of the Finance Committee said they should look at everything and then decide. But the Fiscal Commission did address these issues. We found that the mortgage interest deduction actually is only taken by about 20 to 25% of total taxpayers, and mostly concentrated in the upper end. Part of that is because those are the people that own homes, and part of that is because people in the lower end don't tend to itemize; they take the standard deduction. So what we actually did was we phased out the deduction and we replaced it with an across-the-board credit that anyone could get, regardless of whether they took the standard deduction. And so while it would give less of a benefit to people at the top, it would actually give more benefit to those who don't currently itemize.
I was in the tax business for many years, and I have to say it's the $40,000-$50,000 a year people that benefited the most from the mortgage tax deduction. And since I've been out of the business, I've seen people write out checks for million-dollar homes. It's one of the only deductions that the middle-class person would have.
But you're saying what about that? And would this credit benefit the middle class person?
Yes, I would say, I mean, this credit would be much more, if you look distributionally, most of the benefit to the current mortgage deduction does go to the top. Some middle class folks do get it, and that's important. So seeing this something like a credit would actually expand its availability to the working class and the middle class.
Thank you very much, Linda. Bob in Wisconsin Rapids is with us now. Hello, Bob.
Good morning.
Morning.
You know, we keep talking about cutting this and raising that, and we aren't addressing the problem here. Part of it is because our economy has just been it sucks lately, and we need to get that going. The way to do that is to address our corporate tax level, which is the second highest in the world. Now, Canada's corporate tax level is 16%, scheduled to go to 15%. Their unemployment rate 7%, and it's going down. Communist China's at 25%. We're at 35%. Why would anybody want to have a business here? Now, if we get business going, we're going to have revenue generated. It's going to solve this whole thing.
I think we absolutely need to get the economy going. That's a big part of this solution, although no amount of growth by itself can get us out of this. The PIF6 does call for reducing the corporate rate. They say reduce it by between 23 and 29% and pay for that by getting rid of all these corporate loopholes where the government's picking winners and losers and actually conducting sort of industrial policy through the tax code. I think that would be a huge boon to businesses. Dave Cote, the CEO of Honeywell, wrote a piece yesterday about how important that could be, both to give businesses certainty and optimism about investing here instead of abroad.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I follow that. He said right now the corporate level is 35%. What does that mean?
The corporate tax rate is 35%.
Okay, I just misunderstood what our caller said. Bernie in Elkhorn. Hello, Bernie.
Hi. Just to point out, a lot of corporations like Verizon and General Electric are not paying any taxes whatsoever and, in fact, getting money back. That's how convoluted things are, so don't feel too sorry for the corporations. If you want to get jobs, get rid of the free trade agreements. That's where our manufacturing jobs have gone, and there seems to be bipartisan agreement on those agreements. The middle class is getting screwed with this proposal, which may come to pass. Social Security and Medicare are not the cause of this deficit. We should be looking at military spending, which the guest was way low on. Christopher Hellman has documented we spend $1 trillion a year. The long-term costs of the invasions and occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan are $4 trillion, counting injured soldiers, interest on the debt, et cetera. We're throwing money away on corporate welfare, trillions there. We're a lot of incidentals like foreign aid and the drug war, which could be chopped. Basically, you got two corporate parties. The Republicans, like Paul Ryan, are like pirates, saying we're just going to take your money now. And Obama is just going to whittle you down, taking it out of the people. He is no champion of the people. We need an opposition party. The plan is terrible.
Well, you want to respond to whatever you can there, Mark Goldwine.
Sure, there was a lot there. But I'm just going to disagree with the argument that this plan is bad for the middle class. The gang's plan goes very sharply after defense cuts, sharper than any other credible plan out there. It exempts, in large part, means-tested programs that go particularly to the poor. He reforms the tax code in a way that asks those at the top to contribute the most more and lowers rates for everyone. It makes corporations more competitive by lowering their rates, but it also gets rid of all of the corporate loopholes. And lastly, and most importantly, it gets our debt under control. If we don't make Social Security solvent, there will be a 23% cut for everyone. And if we don't get our debt under control, we are going to have a fiscal crisis. And that's going to look, and that could look just like the financial crisis we just had, except for with no one there to bail the United States out. The absolute most inhumane thing we can do is nothing. And unfortunately, that's the most popular plan in Washington.
Yeah. So there are, Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin says we don't need to raise the debt limit. We just have to live within our means.
Well, I think it's unrealistic to think that we could possibly cut spending enough this fast to avoid any further borrowing. We've already made those decisions to tax people too low and to increase spending too high. Of course, the economic recession escalated it, so the deficit is far higher now than it would be in normal times, given our decisions. But we can't just renege on our past decisions. We need to make reforms going forward. Mm-hmm.
When Bernie mentioned that big corporations like GE aren't paying any taxes at all, would this change that? Would this plan change that?
Right. Well, I mean, there's two reasons that a corporation could have low tax liability. Because they legitimately deserve low tax liability because their net profits are very low for whatever reason, or because they're taking advantage of a lot of the deductions, tax breaks, special depreciation rules, and other benefits in the tax code. This plan would wipe out that second excuse. This plan would put all corporations on a level playing field where they all face a lower rate than they do now, but they can't take advantage of all those loopholes.
Our guest is Mark Goldwine, Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. He's explaining to us this compromise plan, this bipartisan compromise plan from the so-called Gang of Six. You know, what's in it? What does it call for? Will this be the answer to long-term deficit reduction? Will this break the stalemate in the debate over raising the debt limit? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. It's going to be a sunny hot and humid day, especially in southern Wisconsin today. Certainly not as hot as it has been. The heat wave is moving east. There is a slight chance of afternoon storms in southwest Wisconsin. High temperatures today, mid-80s to low 90s. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. 10 minutes before 8 o'clock on this Thursday, July the 21st. Coming up after 8, we'll welcome in the author of the new book, The Believing Brain. And we'll talk about how beliefs are formed and why we believe what we believe and how beliefs can be extinguished as well. That's coming up in our next hour. Right now, we're talking about the debt ceiling debate and the need for deficit reduction with Mark Goldwein, Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. And our next caller is John in Racine. Hello, John.
Hello. Social Security is a separate program, separately funded, with enough funds to pay make payments that are needed for the next 27 years without default in that program. The payments go to retired people, disabled people, and the children of retired and disabled people. This is part of our social infrastructure, and what I see is we're now in an economic crisis caused by not funding the expensive projects which Congress has voted for. And just like Jesse James, the legislature is going to a place where the money is. And James, of course, banks and now the Social Security program. But with an average person getting $14,000 from Social Security, how does that compare to somebody, the taxes, even at $250,000, people say, no, we can't raise the tax on those people, but we're willing to go and take money away from people getting $14,000.
Yeah.
All Americans pay into Social Security. All Americans benefit. It's worked for 80 years. We shouldn't tap that part of our infrastructure at this time of crisis when it is not part of the problem.
Your response to that, Mark Goldwein?
Well, no one in the gang is talking about cutting Social Security now in order to reduce the deficit. What they're talking about is putting it on a sustainable path so that it will be able to remain solvent for its own sake. My organization did a study, and we found that if you acted right now to fix Social Security, you could do it with something that, with a change that was on average about 2% or 2.5% of payroll. That is, the average policy change would be the equivalent of raising your taxes by 2%. If we waited just 15 years, that number increases to 3%. And if we wait another 10 years after that, it increases to 4%. So the longer we wait, the more expensive it is to fix this problem. More importantly, the less time we have to plan. You know, the Fiscal Commission recommended raising the retirement age to age 69 by 2075. That means that little kids now are going to retire at age 69. I think it's good to give people that type of time to plan. It's probably a little melodramatic to be that concerned about a change that's going to phase in over the next 50 to 75 years.
So what is the big deal with raising the tax rate for the very rich? Wouldn't that also help reduce deficit spending?
You mean in the general income tax rate or for Social Security?
No, he was saying that we're going to cut Social Security, but yet we won't touch taxes on the rich. So, why don't we increase taxes on the very wealthy?
Well, I think the Gang of Six plan would ask for more from the very wealthy. As I mentioned before, the Fiscal Commission's plan asked the very wealthy, the top 0.1%, to contribute 11% more of their income to taxes. Now, you don't have to do that by raising their rates, which is economically more damaging. You can actually ask for more while lowering rates by getting rid of a lot of these loopholes, which frankly go mainly to the top 20% and the top 1% of Americans.
So it's doing this through the closing of loopholes, but won't raise taxes on the very rich.
It won't raise rates
right.
on the very rich.
Yeah.
In fact, it'll reduce rates, which is good because people, almost all economists believe people make decisions based on their marginal rate. And so economically, it's best to get the rate as low as possible. Now fiscally, it's best to get as much revenue as possible. And what the gang has here is a win-win, where they can get the rate really low, but still bring in a lot of revenue by closing all these loopholes.
Scott in Green Bay is with us. Hello, Scott.
Good morning. Actually, I think your guest just answered my question, and it had to do with He was talking about making corporations more competitive, predominantly probably C corps. But I was actually curious about S corporations because if marginal rates did go up, small business actually gets. I'm a small businessman, and if you've got you and your wife working in a business, and then your company shows any profitability, which is typically in receivables and inventory, it's really not something you have in your hand. If you raise marginal rates, S corporations end up bearing the brunt of that and paying a lot more taxes. But it sounds like that's not going to occur. I was hoping your guest could touch on that.
Mm-hmm. It's always great when I answer the question before it's asked. One of Dave Cote, who was on the Fiscal Commission and one of the CEOs of Honeywell, one of the things that always was so important to him is that everyone's rates be the same. He felt that, you know, if you get the individual rate down to 28%, you get the corporate rate down to 28%, you get the dividends rate to 28%, suddenly people aren't trying to game the system, you know, to decide whether they want to be a C corp or an S corp or an individual, depending on what the tax code says. They're making decisions based on what's best for the economy and then letting the tax code tax them after that.
Well, we just have a few more minutes to go here. Yesterday, President Obama did call people, congressional leaders, back to the White House. And, you know, because time is running short, the question on the table there was, what will it take to muster enough votes from both parties to get some legislation through the House and the Senate and be able to raise the national debt limit? I'm going to pose that question to you, Mark Goldwein. What will it take to muster enough votes from both parties to do something here?
That's an interesting question. I guess I'm reminded of something that Al Simpson, former senator, likes to say, which is that small ideas have no power to inspire. I think the only way that we get out of this, or I think the best way to get out of this, is to do something big, something where everyone can jump off the vote together in the spirit of shared sacrifice and actually show that they solved the problem. The more cynical alternative is we do the absolute minimum and everybody just walks away saving face. I don't think that's what our policymakers want. And I think we will see a willingness to make some really tough choices in order to actually solve this problem.
Yeah. Well, so you are optimistic that this Gang of Six proposal will likely be a big part of the solution.
You know, I am optimistic. I think there's a tremendous willingness in the House. I'm sorry, in the Senate. I think there's a tremendous willingness from the White House, and I think Speaker Boehner and many of his colleagues want to find a way to be there. So yeah, I'm optimistic.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for being with us. Mark Goldwein, Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Thanks very much to Rob Ferret, to Bill Martins, and to Chris Molina for producing this program, for producing all of these programs, and thank you for listening and for calling in. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. Coming up, we are going to be talking about our beliefs and why we believe what we believe. We will be talking with Michael Shermer, who is a well-known skeptic, and he is the author of The Believing Brain, From Ghosts and Gods to Politics and Conspiracies, How We Construct Beliefs and Reinforce Them as Truths. That's coming up in our next hour. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.